This is Jazz of Enchantment, a radio series spotlighting just some of the talented jazz players with ties to New Mexico. I'm Paul Ingalls. Alto saxophone master Frank Morgan, now in his mid-70s, knows a thing or two about making the most of a second chance. If you spend any time with him, you'll learn that the former New Mexico resident knows the meaning of gratitude, too. He even labeled a track on his 1989 CD release, Gratitude. And if you play that track, you won't hear Morgan play a note on his sax.
I would first like to thank you, the listener, for saving my life.
Jazz fans threw Morgan a lifeline in the mid-1980s when he emerged from a 30-year struggle with heroin addiction. Like his idol Charlie Parker, Morgan was, in the early 1950s, captured by what he calls the Dragon. His devotion to drugs pulled him away from budding stardom in the rich Los Angeles jazz scene and landed him in jail for many years. Once he came clean in the 1980s, Morgan's gift for playing came rushing back, as did the public's attention. Since his 1985 reintroduction CD called Easy Living with the Cedar Walton Trio, Morgan has issued nearly 20 well-received albums of music and played in most of the top music clubs and halls. Even a stroke in 1998 hasn't stopped him from writing a new wave of critically acclaimed sessions and appearances. Before leaving his adopted home of Taos, New Mexico in late 2005 for his birthplace, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Morgan talked with Roy Durfee about his turnaround, saying that many people helped him out of the hole he'd dug for himself.
Central factor of it all was that I was tired, you know. I was tired of being a damn fool to the extent that I would spend my life in prison, you know, and not, you know, ever have seen New York. I didn't even see New York until I opened at the Village Vanguard in 1986.
Wow, I knew that was your first gig in New York. That was your first visit, huh?
Yes.
That must have been quite an experience.
Oh, that was awesome. I don't even know how I survived that day. I mean, I was, you know, was being chased around with, you know, by CBS Sunday Morning, and the Associated Press was doing a big thing on me. You know, I mean, I didn't even have time to rehearse for the recording part of the date that we were going to do, you know, because I was really so busy doing interviews. Not that I regret any of it. I mean, it's just, damn, it was just awesome. I mean, doesn't really describe it, you know. To walk in the Village Vanguard and at 7 o'clock when I start playing at 9:30, and just walk around and feel the vibrations of John Coltrane and all of the other masters that have played there, you know. Wow, you know.
Well, Frank, tell me a little bit about how you think your music has evolved. I mean, I guess you recorded your first record in 1955, and then it was your last recording for 30 years. Did you feel different about your playing when you hit the Village Vanguard finally in 1986 than you'd been feeling on Central Avenue in 1955?
Well, yeah. I mean, I felt like a brand new kid. I was able to deal with the tension or the stress that came about from being just so nervous about the Village Vanguard or nervous about New York that caused me a lot of trouble earlier in my life. When I finally got to New York, I felt the responsibility of it, you know, to get it together, you know.
How did you manage to hook up with such an outstanding ensemble as Cedar Walton's Trio right out of the box, so to speak?
They asked me, you know, like Fantasy asked me within reason, what rhythm section would I like to record with, you know? And I told him one of the people I'd never met, but would certainly like to play with was Cedar Walton. And and not realizing that it by having Cedar, it gave me the ability to have Billy Higgins right out of the box, and to have whoever was currently playing bass with Cedar Walton's trio.
Yeah, I think it was Tony Dumas and then Buster Williams. So it doesn't get a whole lot better than that, but...
No, I mean, it's just... I've always felt that I need all the help I can get, you know, so several dreams realized at one time. Frightening too, you know, Roy. It was really frightening because, it brought me right into the now, you know.
Uh huh. That was quite quite a jump.
It isn't easy to deal with success after you've been, you know, so excellent at failure, you know.
Failure didn't seem like it was in the cards for Morgan early on. Young Frank was being groomed to follow in the footsteps of his famous dad, jazz guitarist Stanley Morgan, until he got his head turned around by the saxophone of Charlie Parker.
When Charlie Parker stood up to take his first solo, my father said that I said to him, "That's it for the guitar, Pops. You know, that's what I want to play." And I was lucky enough that he knew Charlie Parker well, and he took me backstage and. The next day, Charlie Parker insisted I start on clarinet, which I was really, you know, kind of mad with him about that. But the greater wisdom, became available to me later on, you know, because I see that the clarinet helped me a lot in forming an armature and knowing that you had to keep your face muscles in order to play your instrument, right?
A little older, Frank wound up in a somewhat legendary high school band program in Los Angeles.
So basically, when you mentioned Jefferson High School and going there with Billy Higgins and Don Cherry, and I guess Dexter Gordon was there at some point too. We're talking about Jefferson High School in Los Angeles and the great Samuel Brown,
yes,
band director there.
Yeah, a mentor, a real mentor to many of us. You know, it was just such a beautiful thing to. Be exposed to him on a daily basis. I mean, I looked forward to going to school, man, you know, because my last three classes in the afternoon were with, with Dr. Brown. It was quite a job to keep us in school enough to comply with, with everything, because we were really in demand for assemblies, you know, all over the city, you know. In fact, that's when I first met Elizabeth Taylor. You know, she was going to university, high school in Beverly Hills, I guess it was.
Oh, no kidding! So you were hobnobbing with the stars then, as a young man?
Oh, I wouldn't say hobnobbing. I was in the same place with many of them.
Okay, all right. Yeah, well, I don't know what hobnobbing means, but I guess I just meant hanging out. So is it true that Duke Ellington invited you to go on the road with him in the late 40s when you were still in high school?
Well, I auditioned for Duke when I was 15. Ray Nance took me and I auditioned for Duke. And he begged my father to let me go go on the road with him, and my father said, you know, that I needed to go to school, you know. And my well, Duke said, well, you know, I have several doctorates, and I'll be his tutor, you know. And my father said, that's what I was afraid of, you know. When I auditioned for Duke, there were like six ladies in waiting in the dressing room, you know.
Oh, okay.
And he was holding court, you know. And I guess that's what my father was saying, you know, be great for the music, but maybe a little more than I can handle, you know. And, you know, there's some truth to this, a lot of truth to that, because as I look over my life, if there's one thing that I would have to acknowledge, is that there's a strong possibility, even a probability, that I may have had too much too soon.
Yeah, but basically, when I was reading up a little bit on your early years and thinking about some of the conversations we've had, I was just thinking about how it must have felt to been on a bandstand with players like that in your late teens and early 20s.
Yeah, I mean it's something that when I look back upon it, you know, to this time, I mean it's just so much in awe, like just, you know, like the years that I spent, you know, playing in between Dexter Gordon and Wardell Gray, you know, and Art Farmer or Ernie Royal, you know, at different times, you know, and Sonny Clark and I were roommates, you know.
Wow. Yeah, there's another great player.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, we both got introduced, to the Dragon, you know, at the same time.
Well,
yeah, it's just great. It's just great to be alive. I'm lucky to be alive.
I mean, I knew you were going to say that. Yeah, you know? I was going to say that for you.
Yeah, thank you. Don't let me forget it.
Were you listening to music between 55 and 75? Did you have music in prison? Did you have music where you were living?
Not too much in prison. There were, you know, moments when you could catch some of it. No, during the time that I was in and out of prison, I wasn't hardly listening to any music. I don't know if you know it, but, during that part of my life, I didn't play and use drugs at the same time, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, was that a matter of principle or just a matter of habit?
Well, yeah, it was a matter of principle. I felt that, you know, that the music deserved my full attention, and just as I felt that the drugs deserved my full attention when I was that committed to that, you know.
So it almost sounds like just when people were listening and expecting great things of you, you would kind of back away from the music and hide behind whatever else you were doing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, hide behind failure, you know. Look how the world is treating me, you know. Well, I mean, I'm saying that because, you know, we're right back to the point. Look at the way the world is treating me now, you know.
Pretty well, it looks like.
Pretty well, and I think it has something to do with the fact of how I treat myself now, you know. I once had a wise man to ask me, how are you treating life this morning, you know? And I said, oh, come on, don't you mean how is life treating me? He says, no. He says, I want to know how you're treating life. Then I will know how life is treating you.
I've seen you in performance many times, most recently just down in Truth or Consequences, and you made us set the chairs up in a circle so that you could perform like sort of in the round, and there's a way in which you relate to your audience. Is that Is that something that you've just picked up in your later years, or have you always had this sort of warm relationship with your listeners?
Well, it's something that I've always sought to have, you know. I've always wanted to have that kind of relationship. You know, now, because of my age and notoriety, I'm able to do it a little more, you know. You're able to get things like done like the way you want them, you know. You know, even to setting, like just even to setting the chairs up, you know, after being set up another way, you know. I love people, period, and I certainly love, you know, the people that I play for, you know.
And you even had high school kids down there in Truth or Consequences lining up to have their picture taken with you.
Oh, that's great. That's so beautiful. I mean, they make me cry all the time, you know. I mean, really, I'm just a happy old man. You know, not meaning to get, you know, maudlin about it or anything, but I feel so blessed, you know, and I'm trying to live up to it, you know.
How do you choose the music? I mean, you go into a recording session with these cats who can play everything. So, I mean, do you go in there with a list in mind, or do you guys just sort of
work it out? I don't have a list in mind. I kind of like to get the vibe of the different cats I'm playing with, you know? I mean, let that mean something from the very first tune in the date, you know? Just see what the cats feel like playing, you know? Just by fooling around a little bit, you know, and one thing will suggest the next. But you have to have a record date where you're allowed to take that kind of time, you know.
So, well, yeah, it seems to me like you've been very successful in that regard, even with a couple of years off after your stroke. By my count, you've got 17 records out and a couple more on track, you know, to come out in 2006. So that... That seems like a pretty successful recording career for a guy who took off 25 years.
Well, I mean, the grace of God. I mean, you know, just God. I mean, I wanted to say just how much I love New Mexico, and particularly Taos. You know, it's just been a gorgeous part of my life, and I'll never forget it.
Well, Frank, you sound very much at peace and relaxed, and it is great to be alive.
Yes, thank you very much.
Frank Morgan, who says Taos, New Mexico will be on his mind, as he's just recently wrapped up an 8-year stint as a New Mexico resident to move back to the place where he was born, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Frank Morgan was interviewed by Roy Durfee. To learn more about Frank Morgan and to hear more of our interview session, visit our website, newmexicojazz.org. That's newmexicojazz.org, for more profiles of jazz musicians with New Mexico ties. The Jazz of Enchantment radio series is engineered by Nola Daves Moses. Web design, photography, and recording assistance this time from Genevieve Russell. Support for the series comes from the New Mexico Humanities Council, the City of Albuquerque's Urban Enhancement Trust Fund, Good Radio Shows Incorporated, and KUNM. I'm Paul Ingalls.